Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. On today's podcast, we have with us Rob Parsons, our senior editor at Fresnoland and Fresnoland's resident politics expert. Rob, thanks for joining us today.
We're going to start with some headlines. There's been a lot in the news this past week. And I want to start, Rob, with the Fresno EOC, the Economic Opportunity Commission. They've been green-lighted to get an audit to examine this kind of multi-million dollar deficit that they're facing. What's been going on at the EOC?
We would love to know more about what's been going on at the EOC. But yeah, several months ago, late last year, really, this deficit emerged and it quickly grew. At my last check, I think it grew to above $4 million. And that would have been about January. I don't know if the numbers have switched either way since then. But at one point, at least, it was above $4 million. During this time, there was calls for audits, but they never had materialized. Also in the mix of this, Fresno EOC quietly parted ways with its CEO and has not wanted to talk about that or whether there was any connection between this deficit and that departure. But yeah, the board decided to go ahead with this forensic audit. They approved a $123,000 contract with a Milwaukee-based firm. They're going to be looking into the usual how they ran this up, but they're specifically going to be looking into spending by EOC on food services, transit systems, and the Head Start program, as well as the commission's pension and health insurance funds. Wow. So there's a lot to look into on that. They haven't been very forthcoming with information, but they have acknowledged that, yes, they're going forward with this. They're going to get to the bottom of how this happened.
Yeah.
And they deserve to know what happened.
Yeah, Donnie, can you add some complexion to this? What role does Fresno EOC serve? And if their role was retracted, what potential impacts would that have?
EOC receives a lot of federal and state contracts to do everything from rural transit services to Head Start is a huge program that they run. So that's early childhood education and preschool for lower income families. They've had to make some cuts to Head Start recently. They provide a lot of food distribution. We have a lot of food insecurity issues in Fresno County, and Head Start plays a pretty major role in making sure that people are connected to food resources. They provide energy efficiency help. So if you are one of the many thousands of people that's stuck with a really high PG&E bill right now, EOC is one of the places that you would go to get some of your bill paid off if you have the right income requirements. So they do a lot of things to alleviate the burden of living for people who don't make a lot of money. So any cuts and issues with EOC are going to affect people that have lower incomes.
Yeah, it seems like it's a sibling of what our discussion around potential Medicaid cuts.
Absolutely.
And it seems like it's a combination of COVID money going, but also, you know, the new administration's approach to how they allocate federal dollars.
Yeah, and they haven't been super forthcoming about the way that the new administration, the Trump administration, is impacting them just yet. But I don't know how they're not going to be affected given the consistent unrolling of new initiatives that's impacting a lot of federal spending in the area.
We also have an article this week about affordable housing to become part of the Clovis way of life. I love that article title. So affordable housing is coming to Clovis. Tell us more.
It is. Des Martinez is, for those of you who are not familiar, she's a homeless advocate and sued the city of Clovis a couple of years ago, accusing them of basically saying that they're not doing anything to make sure that people who are affluent can live in Clovis. And eventually got through a couple of years of litigation and won. And as part of the settlement for that lawsuit, Clovis had to agree to do a bunch of things, including upzoning a lot of different parts of the city to allow for more apartments. They had to set aside a new fund for affordable housing and affordable housing trust fund. There were a few other policy things that they had to do to basically make it easier. But none of these things basically committed Clovis to building even one unit of affordable housing, which is interesting. And so Pablo Orihuela, our housing reporter, checked in after a year of the settlement being in place to just see, hey, how's it going? Are there issues? And more or less what Pablo heard is everyone's happy with the progress. They've already set aside funding for this affordable housing trust fund. They're making progress on most of the other items on the checklist. So the lawyers and Des are happy with the progress, but it's still going to take many years to get even one unit of affordable housing built. And that's just because of the complexity of what it's like to build affordable housing, where people need 4, 5, 6 different funding sources. You have to get regulatory approvals. You have to find land. You have to piece it all together in the right time frame. So if anyone is living in Clovis or wants to live in Clovis but doesn't make a lot of money, you're still going to have to wait a few more years.
So Madera's got a hospital again.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. So what's the latest on that?
I'm not sure when the announcement went out, but we've been asking, I think as recently as like a month ago, we've been asking the hospital spokespeople, like, when is this going to open? When is this going to open? And we've been hearing like, oh, no date yet. And then I want to say it was like Monday, our reporter Omar Rashad called me and said that the hospital is going to reopen tomorrow, which is great news, but it did feel like it reopened almost as abruptly as it closed. But it's good. It's definitely good news for the community. They have an emergency room. There's doctors. There's nurses. There's still a lot of things that they don't have, and there's no real time frame for when they're going to reestablish some really critical services like OBGYN services. It's not part of the new Madera Community Hospital. But I think for most people, it's like, we got an emergency room.
Yeah,
so
we
got
to establish
a good start.
A baseline of survival. If something happens, you're in a car accident in Madera, you're not driving all the way to Fresno Community downtown. You have a closer path to getting to an emergency room. So that's fantastic.
And for the region, it just gives us more hospital beds. Tim Sheehan from the Central Valley Journalism Collaborative wrote a good story about this. Omar Rashad wrote a good story about this, trying to figure out like how just the addition of these new hospital beds that will have a ripple effect across the valley. For this whole time that it's been closed, this 2+ years, if you lived in Madera or relied on that hospital and you suddenly needed a hospital, you had to make the choice between going to Fresno or going to Merced. So just taking that piece of it out of the equation, I think, is a huge benefit to the entire region.
Fantastic. And then we have an effective close to the end of the Bitwise saga. It appears Jake and Irma have reported to 2 separate federal institutions to serve their nearly decade-long sentences. Is there anything else we should add to that?
I got nothing.
Woohoo? I don't know. Okay.
Soberall was put in USP Atwater, just over in Merced County, and Gwynn, I think, is in Victorville.
So we're going to talk about the Fresno City Council District 5 special election race, which was held this past Tuesday. There's lots of twists and turns and weird Fresno politics to talk about, so be prepared to nerd out with us. But I first just want to set up the story before we go into talking with Rob. So for those of you not familiar with the Fresno City Council, there are 7 seats. District 5 is the district that represents a big chunk of Southeast Fresno, Roosevelt, Huntington Boulevard, Sunnyside area. And it was vacated at the end of last year when Luis Chavez, who was in that seat for 2 terms or nearly 2 terms, was elected to the Fresno County Board of Supervisors and so left that seat open. There were 4 candidates. Rob, talk us through who were the 4 candidates that were going for this seat.
Yeah, absolutely. So we had Elizabeth Jonathan Rosas was a candidate. She's a Fresno Unified trustee and she works for Westlands Water. And she's also the spouse of Luis Chavez. Other candidates, Brandon Vang, Sanger Unified, a trustee, Jose Leon Barraza, a business leader, and Paul Condon, a small business owner, were the 4 candidates for this special election.
Okay, and in this race, if we're setting it out, what was the expectation around the race?
So the expectation, I think, for those of us that have covered this for a while, was that Elizabeth Jonathan Rosas, had the inside track. She's already won several races on her own at Fresno Unified, and then she has the kind of structural support that comes with being an establishment candidate. She had the backing of unions and things like that.
Okay, and that structural support, can you flesh that out a little bit?
She had both union and developer and business support, which is sometimes unique and somewhat unicorn-y to get both of those. And she had not just the building trades unions, but she also had police and fire unions. So she really had the whole gamut of union support. And then she had business leaders like Ed Cashin, major developer in town, has a huge development in Southeast Fresno called Fancher Creek. She had his support and other business leaders as well.
So it seems like she relied on that institutional support. And then Vang, what was his approach in the campaign?
Very different in that front. They raised similar amounts of money, but Most of his campaign contributions were from private individuals for amounts less than $1,000, a lot of family members. Some donations came in, a lot of supporters from like the Hmong community in Fresno, but even other states, Minnesota, Oklahoma, some of Vang's extended family, Elk Grove, I think, also gave. And that's how he built his kind of campaign war chest and actually out-fundraised her just by a hair, but he had more money than she did. I think he had about 122 going into Tuesday, and she had about 120,000.
The election was last Tuesday. What happened?
It's not over, because of course not. This is California, and our races can never end on the nights they're supposed to.
We like to count slowly.
We're counting,
so we get them.
We're counting very slowly, and it does matter, of course. I don't mean to make that sound like criticism of the clerk's office or anything else.
It's annoying.
But as a reporter, I would like some sort of definitive conclusion, please, and I'd like it to fit in a nice, neat box for me, if you could.
Let's clarify for people what quantities we're talking about, because the actual total votes here, it's a couple thousand votes.
It's an incredibly low turnout in this race. We're at almost 13% turnout. So a total of 4,541 votes have been counted so far, and we're not going to get much above that. We're expecting maybe another 100 to maybe 200.
And there's about 75,000 to 80,000 people that live in this district. That's not the registered voters. That's people who live in the district.
So was this a particularly apathetic election? It's just a one, because it's a special election, so it's one off. And so there's not like a catalog of things you're showing up to vote for.
Correct.
Can we attribute that to the low turnout?
Absolutely. And the clerk did. And it's one of the reasons why it's been harder to determine if this race is going to end or not, because Vang is right on the cusp of being able to declare victory.
Because he has to have north of 50%, right?
Yeah, 50% plus one, and he's over the top.
So it looks like he has 50, according to the chart that you have on the article, you have 50.14%?
Correct.
What is that 0.14? Is that like 10 votes or something? Okay. Let's say it does go to a runoff. What does that look like?
The election would be held, we've been told, probably in July. And it would be, just those two candidates now duking it out for the next 3 months.
Oh, okay. Let's break this down, because there's a number of currents going on right now. This past election year was a real anti-incumbent year, not only locally, nationally, but also globally. Are we seeing that as what's going on in this particular race? And I know there's no incumbent here, but the association of EJR with her husband and that kind of relationship, are we seeing this as an incumbent situation, or is there another reason that pulled Vang to the top?
Yeah, like you said, there's no incumbent, but I think there's definitely a strong pull in recent months against perceived establishment politics. Vang was certainly, based on who contributed to campaigns, I think it's a very fair assessment to say he was not the establishment pick. If you're going by that metric, then he would overperform. And then it was just a few months ago that, if listeners remember, Councilmember Nick Richardson, also not the establishment pick, also outperformed and ended up beating someone with a much, much larger campaign war chest, much bigger political establishment support. So that's like the last two races that we've seen in Fresno, not a huge sample size, but yeah, I think both those results were surprising to people who pay attention to these things on the inside.
So that's probably, maybe we can say that's the tectonic factor. It's the big mover underneath the surface, but then there's also the local factor. So what are the local factors that set him apart?
In early March, a mailer went out accusing candidate Brandon Vang of, quote-unquote, alleged statutory rape. It was a pretty misleading mailer in that it said that he was accused of this. There's no evidence that he was ever accused of that we found, and we looked pretty hard. The DA's office has confirmed they don't have any record from the 90s or any other time of any criminal investigation. No criminal charges were ever filed. So I'm not sure where the mailer gets that he was accused of this. But it was complicated. Like all the best shady as hell propaganda, it was just truth adjacent enough, though, that Vang couldn't blow it off. He had to explain. And he and his wife, in several interviews, eventually acknowledged that, when their first child was born in 1993, he was 20 years old and she was 15. But they insist that he never did anything wrong. He was never accused of any crime. And they have no regrets. They're a tight family. They're a good family. And they were pretty outraged that someone would come at them this way. I think that for them, the feeling was, you're going after this guy's family. You're going after this guy's children. The child is now would be in their 30s. But still, it was pretty dirty politics from their perspective. But the Vang camp insisted that this was actually all backfiring. And they were actually getting a lot of sympathy vote and a lot of sympathy support from people who just felt like this was such a just such a kind of classic piece of dirty politics to just drag a guy's family into this and then deliberately leave out certain pieces of pretty important context.
Did any of the other campaigns comment on the mailer that we know about?
They all denied having any involvement with the mailer because it was put out by this political action committee, and that would be, it would be illegal for the candidates to coordinate with this political action committee. But it was, in fact, this action committee that raised some even more serious questions.
What do we know about the political action committee?
They're a thing called Fresno Future Forward, and their listed treasurer is a guy identified as Riley Moore, and that's pretty much the beginning and end of what people know about them on the record. Shortly after the mailer kind of made headlines, the Fresno City Attorney's Office came out and said they were going to do an investigation and they were going to unmask this group. Jan said that he was going to investigate this group because they hadn't filed their paperwork properly. There was no telling who they were. Nobody had been identified. So he makes this statement on a Monday or a Tuesday, and then by the next day, the group has updated its website, or excuse me, its records. The group has updated its records, and now they've identified their treasurer. And Jan's told multiple reporters, that's the end of our investigation. This 24-hour period, they didn't send any subpoenas, or if they did, they pulled them back. And that's, I guess, the end of it. But a lot of us still have more questions, like, who was this campaign? And one of the questions that's just really sticking for me is, in the mailer, they cited this 1993 child support lawsuit. That even the record that I saw, it's clearly marked confidential. So this is a confidential court record from 32 years ago that somehow wound up in the middle of this political campaign. And I'm just puzzled why nobody seems in any particular hurry to solve the question of how do you get your hands on a 32-year-old confidential document for a campaign?
What does this say about dark money and politics in Fresno County?
It's a relatively new phenomenon that we're starting to see a little bit more. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the state's campaign finance laws have changed in the last few years, where if you are a developer, if you are a business owner, if you have someone who is going to have business in front of that city council, you can't give more than $500 to campaigns anymore within a year of you needing to do business with that body. So that's really muzzled a lot of developers in this town and other business interests, whether they're running a cannabis shop or something like that. And so I think we're going to only see more and more of these dark money groups, if you will, these PACs that don't require disclosure of every single donor, because that's the way that you can get around it. And it is legal for them to do that. And Fresno doesn't have very sophisticated ethics laws. We don't have an ethics commission that regulates this emergence of more hidden actors in terms of campaign finance. In a lot of other cities, there's a commission usually that looks at to make sure that city contractors aren't circumventing the rules in that way, to make sure that they're having influence to get their bids chosen. We just don't have that type of infrastructure in Fresno.
The Wild West is not dead.
We are truly the Wild West, in my view. This is my personal take when it comes to ethics and campaign finance. Absolutely.
Let's talk about the EJR of it all. There was a lot of expectation with the institutional support that she should win this race handily. What's been the messaging from her campaign? What are they saying about the results and the outcome?
Not much. I think they're very much waiting for all the votes to be counted. It's a pretty typical response from a politician who's on the edge. But she's got a good case. There's a strong possibility in my mind that we're going to face a runoff. May even have a recount or two before we get there. Vang is at 50.1% right now. So it wouldn't take much more than a handful of votes to drop him below 50%. And if he wakes up on Thursday morning at 49.2%, I could see a scenario where he'd say, yeah, count him again, make sure I'm not actually above 50. And vice versa, if he climbs to 52% in your EJR on Thursday morning, yeah, I'd want to make sure that I got all my votes in there too. It won't take very much to move this needle. So I think that the likelihood is we're going to see probably a recount. And then it could very easily go to a runoff, right, when you're at 50.1%. It's just razor thin right there. But the actual margin between the two candidates is pretty wide, given that.
Yeah. So maybe we have a delayed outcome, but it seems likely that we're going to have the outcome that we currently have. And if that's true, how does this change city council? What does this do to our city council?
So the D5 council seat has, you know, who, which was formerly represented by Luis Chavez, is typically part of a voting block. And I would say this is not all the time, but this is often of the South Fresno City Council members. So you have District 1, which is Power District, Fresno High, West Central Fresno. You have District 3, which is downtown and southwest. District 7, which is more central Fresno, and then D5. Those are the four South Fresno districts. And whoever joins this seat could potentially operate in a block with the South Fresno residents. There was an ordinance, I'll let Rob go into it recently, around smoke shops. And actually, I'm just going to turn it to Rob.
Yeah, just having this seat vacant on the council has created situations where, I think it was 2 weeks ago, the city council deadlocked 3-3 on an ordinance that targeting smoke shops. The ordinance, had it passed, would have forced several dozen smoke shops to close. And there was this long debate. It was a 2 or 3 hour debate on the dais. By Fresno political standards, it got pretty heated. It got pretty tense. And in the end, they couldn't do anything because it was 3-3. So they need this vote on there to break the tie either way for that.
Something I'll say, though, is that in this conversation around anti-incumbency, I think there's sometimes a tendency for people to equate anti-establishment candidates with progressive candidates. And I don't think that's what we're seeing here in Fresno. Nick Richardson, who was the anti-incumbent candidate who won Council District 6 representing Northeast Fresno in November, he's a Republican. He would say he's not bought by any special interests, and that frees him up to make decisions at his own whim and to listen to his constituents better. But he doesn't necessarily bring a progressive view to the council in a way that I think some people imagine people who are not bought by establishment interests, so to speak, would.
You just need to see his campaign signs to understand that he's holding a firearm in them.
Yes. He's like a, I think he like has branded himself like a Captain America
person. Yeah.
And then Brandon Vang, similarly, I don't think has really telegraphed this progressive vision or progressive future. I think he's still pretty pro-development, pro-police, pro-free market in a lot of ways that don't necessarily say that he's going to split with his colleagues on a lot of issues around those topics. But it just means that he might have a little bit more wiggle room to make decisions on his own than others might.
Okay. Is there anywhere else we want to go with this? I feel like we covered a lot of the things. Let's just close with, when do we get our next ballot drop? What's the day and time?
Wednesday, end of day, is what we've been told.
Okay. All right. We'll be watching that. We close each of these podcasts with what we're loving this week. And I'm going to start because I'm excited about what I was loving this week. Last Tuesday, so a week ago, we had three books that came out the same day that I bought on the same day. Three books. I don't normally buy that many books in a row, but I bought all three. The first one, and this is one that Donnie and I have been talking about because it's a big conversation starter right now in kind of politics world. It's called Abundance. It was co-written by Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson, both journalists. It's really about liberalism rethinking itself and how it can build. Liberalism has become a political philosophy that is more about lawyers and stopping projects and less about building and development. And so it's been an interesting book. I'm about halfway through. I'll give a full report on that later. The second book in my trinity of books that I purchased that day is the new Michael Lewis book, Who is Government? The Untold Story of Public Service. It's a really cool concept. So he got a bunch of incredibly famous writers to write vignettes, federal employees and the things that they do. So everyone from Dave Edgars to Geraldine Brooks, and I got the audiobook version, so I get to listen to them read these stories. And they're not quite bedtime stories, but they're very enjoyable. And then the last one is a science book, and it's called The Social Genome, The New Science of Nature and Nurture. And it's a fascinating look at genetics, and what it really shows is that our social environment actually influences our genetics. This kind of duality between nature and nurture is a false duality, and we're learning so many fascinating things about how our social environment affects our genes. And so I bought all those three of those books, and I'm piecing my way through them, but they're all great, and it's been an enjoyable kind of week in publishing. Rob, what are you loving this week?
The thing that I'm loving this week is actually also a book, but particularly for today on Tuesday, it is a thing called National Tolkien Reading Day.
Oh.
And so I will be rereading The Lord of the Rings, probably the Two Towers.
I haven't read them. I read them in adolescence. So I haven't picked them up.
Picked it up since high school.
Yeah.
I was in my 20s when those movies were really popular, and I obviously really enjoyed those movies.
I think, Donnie, you read them every year, right? Like annually?
I feel like I'm destined in life to be surrounded by Tolkien fans. And it just keeps happening everywhere I go.
It's not a bad thing. It means they've got good attention spans. It means they like orcs. Like, it's all good stuff,
Jordan,
right?
Jordan knows. I don't know if I've told you this story, Rob, but like for one of my first dates with my now husband, Scott, he was like, oh, let's watch one of the Lord of the Rings movies. And I'm like, okay, sure, why not? And I fell asleep within the first 20 minutes.
They're long movies. Maybe he just was looking for a long date, because that keeps you there for 3 hours at a minimum.
And it broke his ever-loving heart, and he never ceases to stop bringing this up in conversation 20 years later.
He's been trying to save you ever since.
So the hobbits just didn't keep you up. Those hairy feet.
I'm not a big fantasy person.
I do have a similar story for my marriage. But it's a little flipped. My wife is the bigger Tolkien fan between us. So, yeah, I wasn't allowed to fall asleep.
I did revisit The Hobbit in adulthood and actually found that landed pretty well for me. I also like that it was a bit shorter. But, yeah, so you're planning to do it over the course of the year? Like all three?
I'll probably pick it up on Tuesday and just flip through a couple of chapters.
It's fun. It's kind of like nostalgic almost to open it up and just kind of.
And I feel like maybe it's because of the movies, or maybe it's because I just read them too much in high school, but I feel like I can also just pick one of them up, open it in the middle, and just start reading.
It is interesting. You guys know that HBO's redoing Harry Potter, right? Have you heard this?
I haven't.
Yeah, so they're redoing it. I would be curious to see what a redone Lord of the Rings would be like. It's a huge project, but maybe it needs prestige television to give it a new life. I don't know. Donnie, what are you loving this week? Lord of the Rings? The Hobbit?
Nope, none of those. So I have been slowly making my way through a book that one of our former guests on this show told us about called Billion Dollar Loser. Have you read this story?
I have not, no.
Yeah, it's about the founder of WeWork, Adam Neumann, and the rise and fall of WeWork as a company. And I don't love fantasy because the characters are too clean and neat. Mm. And I like complex characters that have a bit of good and evil in them that you can really see hashing it out. And Adam Neumann is very much that character. Mm. And a humble guy from Israel who had this interesting idea to provide office space for other people. And then the sort of search for constant funding and venture capital just turned to him into a different person, and the company into this really weird and enigmatic company. So I love stories like that.
Are you, given that we just talked about the kind of the closing chapter of Bitwise, is it changing any perspective on Bitwise because they're such parallel tracks? Are you seeing things that are maybe similar and different, or changing your perspective?
I think just the culture that Adam built at WeWork was very much influenced by his spiritual relationship to Kabbalah. He was Jewish and practiced Kabbalah. And I think that there's definitely some parallels between that and the way that Jake and Irma built culture at Bitwise. And I think there's a lot there to probe and talk about more.
Is it inspiring you to start your own cult?
No, but I was having a conversation with a lot of friends recently, and they were making a list of all the cult documentaries I need to start hitting up. And I decided that because I don't ever have time to watch movies, I basically only get to watch Gabby's Dollhouse with my daughter. And so when I ever have free time, I just want to have a whole weekend to watch cult documentaries, which might actually be this weekend.
Ooh, have you watched the NXIVM one?
No.
That one's a good one. Rob, do you have any cult documentary recommendations? There's a lot of them out there, I feel like.
Yeah, I don't remember the name of it, but I know I watched a documentary, I think it was last year, on Jim Jones. I'll look that up and make sure that one.
Yeah.
There was one, Wild Country, that came out a few years ago. I'm forgetting the premise, but it's a small town taken over by Indian guru, and there's wild stuff ensues.
Maybe everyone else is going to be making their March Madness brackets, and I'll make a cult documentary bracket and report back on how that goes.
Yes, in other words, we are out of touch. And this is Fresnolandia.
No one belongs here more than you.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.